You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
No, not a man, not a human being. I'm a complex space-time event. I am Lord President of Gallifrey, the traveler from beyond time. I am the Sandman, the oncoming storm. I am the Kar-Farak Gatri, destroyer of worlds. And sometimes, only sometimes, I am your worst nightmare. I'm the Doctor, and I take care of my friends.
Welcome to the Oncoming Storm, your weekly Doctor Who spin-off media podcast, featuring Josh Wilson, Ashley Rayburn, Sasha DeZuba, and Rachel Stewart. This is your podcast about Doctor Who that you won't see on television.
Hello and welcome to episode 126 of The Oncoming Storm, your Doctor Who spin-off media podcast, where we talk about everything Doctor Who related that you will not find on television, things from books to audios to comics. I am Josh Wilson. Normally you'd be hearing Ashley soothing dulcet tones on this particular even-numbered episode, but yet he is once again not here, as is typical for somebody of his untrustworthy nature. And so I'm having to do the introductions all by myself again. Also, we have no Sasha for like the fourth time in a row. I guess he's still on the podcast. Maybe he's not dead and floating in the river somewhere. I really hope so. And I'm hoping I'm not getting just like some sort of messages from some sort of version of himself that's just generated from his emails and Facebook posts, and now it's kind of become sentient and is trying to converse with me. So hopefully he's actually still alive and will join us at some point in time in the future. But that's okay, because we still have Rachel. She's dependable. We love her. We have her back. And we're lucky enough to be joined once again by Mr. Jeff Pollier, fresh off of his surgery, drugged up on OxyContin, and still was able to be here and talk about Doctor Who. Take that, Ashley.
Like a trooper.
I know.
I'm the tin dog of the Oncoming Storm.
Well, thank you guys for actually being here, unlike some people. How are you doing?
Really well. My first checkup appointment just went stellar, and so, you know, I'm doing great in my recovery. I'm back to driving at this point, so I'm, you know, not so dependent upon the kindness of strangers or, you know, loved ones.
See,
of course, my loved ones are pretty strange, so
I'd be milking that for as long as I possibly could. I'd be like, oh, I can't drive myself. Yeah, come on, honey.
Oh, I was doing dishes less than a week after surgery, so
You're a trooper. You're a trooper.
The excuses don't work well with me.
And how about you, Rachel? You doing okay? Have we recovered from the Twin Peaks news yet?
No, I will never recover. It will always be amazing. So
I know. It's so exciting and yet so far away.
I feel like that's probably what you guys felt like in the wilderness years.
But when we found out Doctor Who was coming back?
Yeah.
I don't know. There was a lot of trepidation when we found out it was coming back. That's for certain. But we had lots of wilderness years material at that point in time. We hadn't had any Twin Peaks material in 20 some odd years. So
exactly. A drought.
I know. We're lucky to have it back.
It wasn't an entire drought. You had that episode of Psych.
Ah, well.
That's
David
true.
Lynch directed. It just had a bunch of people in it. Actually, that was a good episode. I really enjoyed
it. It was a love letter to Twin Peaks.
Yes, yes, it was. I like Psych. It's a good show. Interestingly enough, I don't know if it was confirmed or just a rumor, but that is going to be the source of our new Luke Cage, evidently. I believe I read that somewhere that I don't know what his name is.
Jaleigh Hill.
Yeah, yes, he has been cast to be, at least, I guess, I read that somewhere. I don't know if it's actually true or just a rumor, but he was going to be Luke Cage. So I don't
that
know.
That seems like a really odd casting choice.
It certainly does. As much as I love him,
he's short.
Yeah, I don't know.
And not buff.
I guess we'll see. If it is true, I don't know. I can't be bothered to actually go fact check myself right now. So you heard it here first. He's definitely playing Luke Cage. All right. So we're going to be talking about the Creed of the Cro-Magnon here tonight. But first, we've got a little bit of discussion time, some fun times here. We're going to go, you know, join in the little circle and have some coffee talk here. Of course, Creed of the Cro-Magnon is pretty much well known for being the introduction of new companion Kerez. And Kerez is notable for being he's still a humanoid companion, but he is an alien. One of the actual few that we've actually gotten in Doctor Who. Interestingly enough, you think there'd have been more, but I thought tonight we kind of talk about why aren't there more alien companions in Doctor Who? Should there be more companions that are aliens in Doctor Who, and how do we make it work? So let's just start off going around the table. I guess I'll start us off. I've always wanted to see more alien companions in Doctor Who. I mean, we had like Nyssa. Nyssa technically is an alien, but she might as well have been a human. But we've never really had somebody that was like an actual real alien. The closest thing we actually really got, like in the old series, I suppose, would have been Chameleon, if you count him as a companion. He was a non-working robot that went along in the TARDIS and then showed back up another episode before being unceremoniously killed off. And I kind of felt like that was always a missed opportunity, especially with the entire universe at the Doctor's fingers. The fact that he doesn't have an alien companion, I mean, I guess from a production standpoint, it's probably harder to do so, but it does feel like it's a missed opportunity. I definitely think we should, especially nowadays when it'd be something that they could very easily do. I mean, you know, Star Trek put aliens, like you have Worf as an alien. I mean, you still have a humanoid alien, but still have an alien on board the TARDIS with a little bit of makeup work each week. It doesn't seem like it would be that difficult.
Go back to the 1960s. You have Mr. Spock.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be all that difficult. I mean, of course, this is a whole discussion altogether whatsoever as far as maybe we should be getting companions that aren't modern women in Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. That would be just something nice to see, something different for a change. But
yes.
I certainly would love to see an alien companion. Just I think it offers all sorts of storytelling opportunities that we don't always get with just human companions.
Well, I think you missed two big non-human companions, Josh. One, Romana.
Well, yes.
As a Time Lord or Time Lady, if you will, not human. And K-9. You forgot the tin dog.
Well, I didn't forget. I wasn't trying to make an all-inclusive list of companions. I was just kind of giving an example of what we had gotten. If you want to go fully into that, I mean, you can go back. Susan technically isn't a human companion. And,
true.
You know, we then move on to, I guess, Leela technically is a human-like companion. I mean, a far-off descendant of humanity.
I don't know. My understanding was that Leela was human, just not from Earth.
Well, I mean, what makes you human? I mean, of course, then we've got Marshman Adric. So, I mean, so there are alien companions, but what I'm talking about is something that is actually, because for all intents and purposes, they really weren't alien. They were from another planet, had some sort of alien background, but for all intents and purposes, they could have walked in off the street, honestly.
Yeah. To get to an actual alien, there's one companion that comes instantly to mind, and it's Frobisher.
Yeah. There you go. I mean, that's something that is actually completely alien. Even if they were to go for just a completely human-looking companion who happened to be an alien, having somebody on board the TARDIS with like different emotional and moral backgrounds would be interesting. I mean, obviously, you're probably going to have a human companion on board, but I think the storytelling possibilities of having the Doctor, a human companion, and an alien companion, and seeing how they play off each other, I think that would be all sorts of great storytelling opportunities there.
Well, and I don't think you have to have a human companion also. There certainly wasn't when Romana was the Doctor's companion.
No, but I mean, from a production standpoint, you've got to look at the way that the execs and everything look at it. You've got to have somebody that they think that the audience at home needs to have to empathize with, because you can't always empathize with the Doctor.
And that's certainly why we've had the companions that we've had since 2005.
Right.
They're human. They're, generally speaking, middle class, maybe even lower middle class, and modern, because they are the identifier characters. Now, I think the BBC may be selling their audience a bit short. I'm not sure we need to have a character that we can identify with like that in order to enjoy the story or to have an emotional connection to the story. I would love to have, you know, if humanoid, still a non-human companion.
Mm-hmm.
Pick a species that we've already seen and have them be a companion. And I'm not just talking Handel's The Talking Head, which was certainly, you know, a nice little touch, but hardly really fulfilling that role of companion that we need.
Well, I mean, just looking at this story we're going to be talking about here tonight, mm-hmm. and so, I mean, spoilers, whatever, but I don't think the story is very good at all. But we do get Kara's added into the group as a new companion. And the fact that we get somebody who ostensibly is acting like a normal person does. I mean, he's got a range of emotions, and yet there are little things about him that are just a little bit odd. And of course they drop a little bit of hints that maybe he's not always as he seems, but I like the idea that we can kind of follow the development and find out why or what makes him an alien during the course of the stories. And I think that's certainly the way that you would go with an alien companion. You'd have somebody who is ostensibly something that could be relatable and has all of our human emotions and things that, and then just kind of peel back the layers to show what makes them an alien and the way that they may react differently than what we might expect or do things a little bit differently. That's what I think makes for a good, interesting story about a companion. You don't have to go and shove them into the entire history of the Doctor to make them interesting.
Mm-hmm. And I guess I'll jump off of what y'all were saying earlier, especially with the new Who audience. I would love to see a alien companion. I'm tired of all these girls that wear Topshop and, you know, have jobs or whatever. And like, I mean, and that's not to say that I don't love them for who they are, but it's just like, I feel like, I mean, I've been watching it since 2005, and it's kind of like, okay, we get it. He really digs Earth girls. Awesome.
But I have heard that Earth girls are easy.
I know.
I was just thinking that. Oh, man.
So, I mean, and I think they have a really interesting dynamic going on this season, but I would love to see him just chill out with, like, other, you know, other people from other places, and we learn about those places. It's not, you know, the companion is the way to the Doctor. If you don't understand who the Doctor is at this point, please turn off your television. He's an alien and he's a Time Lord and he does crazy things. Spoilers.
So, yeah, I think we can probably move on from there into talking about the Creed of the Cro-Men. I think we're all in agreement that we would like to see some alien companions and the possibilities that that would open up. I don't know if we'll ever get that in the way that television works nowadays, but who knows? We'll keep our fingers crossed, and we may be able to get a Kara's at some point in time in the future. We'll see. But let's go ahead and talk Creed of the Cro-Men, and let's take the opportunity to listen to the trailer.
Doctor Who, The Creed of the Cro-Men.
I will not speak. I will not say what I've seen. I ask only that you don't harm Lyga.
Lyga, captured. Medium 5. Selected at induction for reproductive reserve. Status confirmed. Ingested first and second rate Q elixir. Hybridization experiment promising. Advanced to status Q3.
So I wonder where we are.
Well, the landscape seems the same as we saw earlier.
Yeah, dry and dusty. Why wouldn't the Croaker let us through? What's to hide?
There must be life somewhere. There must be technological development.
The Croaker seemed interested in the TARDIS.
We can worry about his interest when we find the old girl.
I was inducted, taken with Lyga to Alpha Sphere. Well, there were hundreds of us. We were graded, assessed for work and usefulness, divided into groups. Everyone was herded away until only Lyga and I were left.
Are the Cro-Men native to this zone?
Oh, no, they're not like us.
You will all remain standing. You will wait for the return of the patrol ship. You will be taken to the Alpha Sphere for interrogation and induction.
And if we refuse?
You have zero choice in the matter.
Ingested final expansion elixir. Consumption successful. End requested information.
We're not your enemy, Garrus. Please believe that.
All right, so that is a trailer for The Creed of the Cro-Men, and of course, as always, spoiler warnings are up. We will be talking about the story in absolute detail, and if you really, really feel like you need to listen to the story before we talk about it, feel free to go listen to it. Of course, you also can feel free to save your money and just listen to us talk about it. Am I being too obvious here? I don't know. Anyway. So, The Creed of the Cro-Men is written by Philip Martin, directed by Gary Russell, with sound design and music by David Darlington. We start off in the story with the Doctor and Charlie traveling through the Interzone. How they know what the Interzone is, or if the Doctor just made it up, I don't know, but he's talking about it as if he's an expert. And as they're crossing this Interzone into a new world, they are stopped by this force called the Croaker. And he is the guardian of the Interzone. He is the one who allows people to enter the different zones in this universe, because evidently this universe is made up of all sorts of different zones, and you can travel between them, but yet there's still space travel in the zones. I don't know. It's all weird and whatever. We don't really get an explanation of it. But he confronts the Doctor and Charlie. He doesn't want to let them into the new zone. He kind of mentally reads Charlie's mind and finds her worst fears and paralyzes her. But the Doctor is able to fend off the psychic advances, and he is able to convince the Croaker that he has knowledge of space travel. And the Croaker decides this might be of use to the inhabitants of the Eutermes zone. So he decides that he's going to go ahead and let them in because he might be of some use to the inhabitants of the Eutermes zone. And he lets them in, and they find themselves in this big desert wasteland. Everything is dry and dusty. And as they are walking through the dunes in search of the TARDIS, they spy a flying car that is chasing a strange-looking man and shooting at him. It seems to get him, and the car flies off. The Doctor and Charlie run to see if this gentleman is okay, and he is still alive. And he is certainly an alien. He has got chameleon type of skin where he matches the materials that he is next to. He's got this big bone thing going around his head, some sort of vestigial bone type of helmet that encases his head. They're able to wake him up, and he tells them that his name is Karez, and that he was able to escape the Crowmen who had captured his people, and were going to turn him and his wife Lyta into a king and queen among the Crowmen. But and the Crowmen, they use these poisons to sow obedience, and they make you drink it, and when you drink it, you then become mind controlled and obey their every whim. But Karez wasn't able to keep this stuff down, so he's able actually to break out of the control and escape. And that's when they chased after him. So they kind of nurse Karez back to health. They decide they're going to go help him free his people from the Crowmen. And they kind of get lost. And they're making the way for the dome to go help Karez and his people, but unfortunately they are captured by the Crowmen, and they are captured along with a friend that they meet, the Urog, who is, for all intents and purposes, I don't know exactly what he looks like, but I imagined him as being a giant mole, because he's kind of this burrowing creature. And they all get captured, and they're going to be taken into this biodome that the Crowmen live out of. They call it the Alpha Sphere, where Karez is convinced that they all are going to be put to death. They get taken into the Alpha Sphere. The Crowmen take Urog away to be pacified and be put to work digging. They take Charlie and Karez. Karez, they're going to turn into a laborer. And Charlie, they think she has the potential to be reproductive stock. So they take her to the genetics lab. And the doctor, meanwhile, has displayed knowledge of science. So they're going to take him to work in the science labs. The doctor and Charlie are able to escape when Karez causes a diversion when they try to pacify him. They escape and go down deep into the tunnels of the Alpha Sphere. They look up to try to find out where Karez's wife Lyta is being held. And so they make their way down to where she is being held to help find her. Karez, meanwhile, has been taken to be turned into a glorified server for these alien Crowmen. And the Crowmen, they're like giant insects. So they like to eat things like regurgitated food, grubs, and worms. And he's pretty disgusted about all this, but he manages to get himself a job delivering the food rather than being one of the people that has to pre-chew it. There, after the doctor and Charlie had been captured again, he meets up with the doctor, who is being interviewed by the head of the science division for space research. And he and Karez are able to go down to the genetics lab to find Lyta and Charlie. They do so, and we find out that Lyta has been turned into a big, giant birthing chamber for the Crowmen. She begs Karez to kill her, and he grabs a gun, and he does so. This, understandably, kind of throws Karez off the deep end, but they are recaptured, and now the only choice that the Crowmen have is, because they've now lost their new queen, is they now are going to turn Charlie into the new queen. And it begins a very disturbing sequence of her being subtly changed into this giant bug thing.
It is not good to be the queen.
No, it is certainly not. Karez is taken and strapped to a water wheel, so he is constantly being dunked dunked into water over and over again, and knowing that this will eventually kill him. And the doctor is taken back to the laboratory where he is going to be pacified, and he is forced to partake in all of the poisons. And it seems to be that he then joins up with the crewmen and starts instructing them on how to build their own spacecraft. And he is working towards getting a working model done for them. Meanwhile, like I said, Charlie's being turned into this alien queen, but the Urog has been able to throw off his own conditioning. He goes and saves Karez and takes him to a hiding place where they can try to hide out until they can escape. But Karez decides that he needs to go try and help the doctor and Charlie. He can't just wait around to do nothing. So he goes out to try to help the doctor and Charlie. Meanwhile, the doctor has put together this big giant space contraption, and it turns out to actually not be a space contraption, but rather instead it's something that explodes to cause a massive diversion so he can try to get away and go save Charlie. He is not able to get down to Charlie, but he does meet back up with Karez and Urog, and they're again taken to the Urog's hiding place, and they kind of sit around doing nothing until the Urog describes that he knows how the Crewmen are getting their water supply, and the Crewmen are solely dependent on massive amounts of water, so if they can disrupt the water supply, they may be able to cause some major damage to the Crewmen. So Urog goes off to free his own people, and also, the Urog has found out a way to find some magical roots and minerals that can break the conditioning. And so he's able to gather some of this to go free his own people. And they're going to go disrupt the water supplies, which is going to cause big problems for the Crewmen. The Doctor and Karez wait around for a bit and decide they need to go try to do something themselves. So they go to try to sabotage the backup sources of water for the Crewmen. They're kind of able to do so, and they're able to finally find Charlie, who they found out that Charlie has been kind of turned into one of these queen creatures, and it looks like they're about to be captured when all of a sudden the Crewmen about to catch them seem to go completely dormant. We find out that by killing the water supplies and killing the queens that were around, because the Crewmen are a hive mind, they need the direction of the queen in order to function, and with the queens being dead, then they can no longer do anything. And so they have won the day by stopping the Crewmen, and the Urog go off to all the other places the Crewmen have settled in on the planet to disrupt their water supply so that the native Utermazins can reclaim their planet, because the Crewmen were invaders from another zone. I didn't go into that earlier. Don't worry. It's not that important. they're able to stop the Crewmen. And Karez, having lost his wife, feels like he doesn't have a place on this planet anymore, so he decides to go and join up with the Doctor and Charlie as they go on to the next zone, not before the Kroka talks to the Doctor, dropping some not-so-subtle hints that maybe Karez is not all that he appears to be. So that is Creed of the Crewmen. Who wants to start us off? Because I don't want to be a negative Nelly, but I didn't like this one very much. What about you guys?
Dude, what even? Like, it's just so gross. It's kind of like, hey, welcome to the Divergent universe where, like, crazy things are going to happen. Enjoy your stay, because it's going to get weirder. Like, you thought that last one was weird? Oh, no. Just wait. Now we're going to turn Charlie into, like, a huge pregnant bug, because that's normal.
But that's normal for Doctor Who. I was able to accept this story much better than the previous Eighth Doctor story.
Jeff.
And even before, I listened to it once, and then went and did some reading on, you know, behind the scenes and stuff, and then listened to it again. And even before I did the reading on the episode, I thought, wow, this reminds me a lot of Vengeance of Eros. And well, there's a really good reason for that. They have the same writer.
Yep.
And so, yeah, this had, even though, you know, some of the concepts are certainly icky and gross, it had a lot more of a Doctor Who feel for me.
I don't know if it's a good thing. I don't know.
No,
Okay, so let's start off with the first point where – so this, I think, really falls flat on the whole Divergent Universe concept, because you mentioned this feels like Vengeance of Varos. And yes, it is written by Philip Martin, and it is basically a Philip Martin greatest hit story. And and that's kind of disappointing to me, because there's nothing in this story that couldn't have been done in a traditional Doctor Who regular universe story. And it after having such this strange and interesting setup from Escherzo for how weird the Divergent Universe is, now we're just on random alien planet X. And honestly, you could not convince me otherwise that this was not a story featuring the mentors and Syl, and he just rewrote to turn into a different alien race that is completely obsessed with commerce.
As we discussed last week, though, Scherzo was too far out for me. And the idea that there are different zones in the Divergent Universe where even physics behave differently, I'm okay with that. I'm okay that this story wasn't as far out there as the previous one. It's still more interesting than In Space. So, you know, familiarity and comfort, you know, the mental comfort of the more familiar settings really did a lot for me. I thought the various races were very interesting. We get, you know, if you count the mysterious voice at the beginning of the end, I can't remember the name of it right now. We get four new races between the Cro-Mons and Kariz's people and the Oruts. And I found those, you know, really interesting to have all these different interactions, and each race behaves differently. So I think there was still plenty of meat to the story, even if it wasn't as weird as you wanted it to be.
Well, okay, I mean, it's a letdown on that end. But even if I give that a pass, and like, okay, you can't always have weird, crazy stuff. You've got to go back to something more traditional at some point in time. Fine. But the fact that I've already seen this story twice before by the exact same writer, and this is how they're leading off for basically to set the tone for the rest of the Divergent Universe arc.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand what they were thinking. Why go this route? I mean, in the next story, we're going to get something that is also strangely different, but still kind of based in a more traditional alien type of world. So that's fine. But here, it just seems to follow up Scherzo with this is mind-boggling to me. Like how they thought that flowing from that story to this story would have any sort of coherence to it whatsoever.
Well, maybe the idea wasn't for it to flow. Maybe it was a rubber band reaction of Scherzo was so alien. Let's go back and give them something, the listeners, something that they can identify with more easily before shifting the other way a little bit again.
I mean, okay, maybe. But to go back to Philip Martin, who, though he may have written some of the better stories in a not so great era, mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't mean that they're actually all that good. And I mean, like, Vengeance and Varus is okay, but it's got a lot of problems with it. And not in the least in the way that it treats women, and he's doing it again in this story.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what's wrong with Philip Martin, but he really seems to have a problem with women. I mean, the stuff that he does to Perry in his two stories previously, and then comes into the exact same thing with Charlie.
This story, though, I don't feel that the women were being targeted, because Kariz was also supposed to be transformed into the king of the Cro-Mons. Now, you know, he wouldn't be being used to generate eggs all the time. But most species, the males don't generate.
It is completely different, though. Let's take a moment. This is something, I mean, this is a heady subject, and we're kind of jumping into a little bit earlier than what I thought we would. But I mean, it's something that we have to talk about here. I'm going to play a quick clip here of what Charlie goes through, and then we're going to come back and talk about it, because it's kind of disturbing.
Play on, McDuff.
No. No, don't want it. Take it away.
Give it to her. She has to ingest this today or we lose the metabolic regression.
Yes. Hold her head. Open her mouth. Force it open.
No.
Hold her still. Make sure it is swallowed. Keep her lips closed.
It is done.
Good.
Okay, so you hear Charlie whimpering as she is having all of this stuff forced upon her as these two Cro-Men stand over and, for all intents and purposes, gloat and force her to take it. I'm sorry, but I mean, this is a science fiction type of story, but I mean, this is rape by any other word. I mean, this is like a rape, science fiction rape thing going on here, and it is just so hard to listen to, and it's something that Philip Martin has done before with the way that he's treated Perry. I mean, he had Perry taken and experimented on twice, and one turned into a just bird creature, and then all the horrible things they did to her in Mind Warp. But I mean, here, this is going up to another level. I mean, that is so hard to listen to. I mean, hear the way that Charlie whimpers at the end of that clip. It's just like, oh my God, are you've got to be kidding me here. I mean, it's only this is a very, very thin veil of metaphor between what's being done to her and for it to actually being rape.
Well, and India Fisher really sells that scene too. Once again, I can't say enough good things about her performance. But as far as the scene itself, would it be nice if we were a little more advanced? And granted, this is a 10-year-old story at this point, but that's nothing new in science fiction and fantasy stories.
But here's the problem. It is something that is so based on in the stories of a less enlightened time of the 1980s. And here we've gotten a story that is essentially retreading what was being done in the 1980s. And it is so out of place now.
Well, and again, what the Cro-Mons also wanted the Doctor and Kariz to be drinking elixirs that would basically be bending their, not just bending their wills, but completely subsuming their wills. And so, well, Charlie is the one it happens to in the story. It's not like she was singled out. It's still a terrible thing. Yes, because the Cro-Mons are a terrible race. But I'm not, and, you know, like I said, the first time I read this, or excuse me, listened to it.
But I mean, I didn't
know the writer had a history of doing that.
But it's also a nature of the levels of what's happening. Yes, other people are being mind controlled, but it's not just mind control with Charlie. She's being forcibly impregnated with these egg things. She's being forcibly changed into something that she's not against her will. I mean, the Doctor gets some magic juice and then goes and gets treated like he's a full partner in this little corporation as he does some sciencey stuff. I mean, there's no real comparison to it. And to make matters worse, nobody seems to really care this happens to Charlie. Like, they're all happy that she's all great and back normal. And it seems to be okay because she doesn't remember it. Nobody seems bothered by it in the least. And it's all okay because Charlie doesn't remember what happened. And that, to me, is just like the wrong message to be saying.
It's not all okay. The Cro-Mons have paid for their crimes. Their society on, you know, at least in this particular zone, has been destroyed as a result of their actions. So it's not okay. It's really a relief for Charlie that she doesn't remember and that this isn't haunting her.
Well, I mean, but it's never brought up again. I mean, this is it's a major thing. You're just listening to it, and it just gets completely wiped away. The whole story, I mean, like, I don't know. It just feels like it
is. Why would it need to be brought up again unless Charlie herself remembers it. It's not like the doctor's
because
going
something
to go.
Horrible happened to her, and it's like we're being it's almost like a torture porn of a story. The fact that it lingers on her ordeal so much, and then doesn't even go into bothering and giving us any sort of resolution for her ordeal is makes it nothing more than sensationalism. It's not that it's being told in order to really give us some sort of greater meaning to the story. It's just there as like torture porn.
Yeah, I just and it's kind of like if you're gonna wipe their brain and they're not gonna remember anything, why did you make them go through that? Like that's just stupid to me. Like, it, well, like that's the thing I hate most of all about any Doctor Who story, or you know,
it is a cosmic reset button. That's true. You know, the only lasting consequence that I know of this story is Cariz joining the Doctor and Charlie. Otherwise, the next story can start off fresh, and they don't have scars from this. But they're also, with all the emotional stuff they went through in the previous story, there's no scars lingering from that in this one either.
Well,
I've got a problem with that too, though. We definitely know that the Doctor and Charlie are being manipulated. Something is being done to them on purpose by this mysterious entity, you know. So, I'm glad that you have a problem that there's no lingering effects in the previous story too, because that was actually a problem for me with this one. Is they were really put through the emotional wringer in the previous story, and in this one, they're just kind of back to normal.
Yeah, and that's a real problem with the story. The fact that the Doctor was put through the ringer, he's got this massive chip on his shoulder, and he is just so full of anger and spite during the course of the story. And here, he's acting like nothing ever happened, like he's just landed the TARDIS and they're off on another adventure. I've got a real problem with that. Again, this is just a story that should not have followed up with the previous one. I mean, it really has no place following up on Scherzo, because it has nothing to do with any of the character changes that happened in that story. These two characters are irrevocably different from where they were before everything happened in Neverland and Zagreus, and the story completely ignores all of that development.
Would you have been more comfortable, I mean, obviously not with the bodily intrusion scenes, but would you have been more comfortable with the other little bits of the story if there was a story between this one and Scherzo?
Maybe, but it's just my biggest problem with this story is just the fact that it is so unabashedly traditional and unthinking of anything that's happened in Doctor Who. It is, again, I think something that Philip Martin wrote in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. It's exactly the same as his other stories, and he just brought it in and put the Eighth Doctor into it, and it just doesn't fit.
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree. This could, unlike going back to Scherzo again, unlike that one, which had to be the Eighth Doctor and Charlie, this one could have been insert any Doctor, almost insert almost any companion, and the story fits them. It didn't have to be Eighth Doctor and Charlie in this one. And, that's a downer for me in this, is that it's not, while the Eighth Doctor and Charlie are in it, and I love them, this isn't necessarily a story that had to be their story. And clearly it wasn't their story before. It was the Sixth Doctor and Barry.
Right. I mean, it just feels like they have put zero thought. And actually, I don't know if I really blame Philip Martin. I blame Gary Russell for picking this story, because this is, I mean, it's a whatever story. It worked in the 1980s for Colin Baker, and they're telling it again. It would have been fine. Like, it had been like some sort of lost story. I mean, it would have been whatever. But here, where we've got this whole new setup and direction for the Eighth Doctor, and to pick this story to go into that is such a huge misstep. And then to not even bother to go and try to make it at least connect with the character growth that we've seen up to this point in time, massive misstep, fail of editorial completely.
I hope I haven't been giving the wrong impression that I love this story, because I don't. I just like it a lot better than you do, but that's setting the bar really low.
Yeah.
Something else that no one else has mentioned in this is that the Doctor and Charlie are able to communicate with everybody, even though the TARDIS is nowhere to be seen.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know how the story proceeds from here, but the TARDIS has to somehow still be somewhere nearby, because clearly they're getting help from the telepathic circuits.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll just have to wait and see about that, won't we?
Yes, we will.
I want to go ahead and talk a little bit about Karras, because, he is the lasting impact from this story. And let's take a moment and play a little clip, and let's meet Karras.
All right.
You were running away. Not exactly a kingly attribute.
Charlie! I wanted to find my home. My piece of land, my village, but it's all dust. Oh, Lyda. Lyda.
Who is Lyda?
The woman I was to join with for life.
Did you escape from one of the biospheres?
Alpha Sphere. I got free. They hunted me down. I stumbled. Fell. Knocked myself out. I must have thought I was dead. They're coming back. I can hear them.
It's just the wind blowing dead tree branches.
Okay, so what do we make of Karras upon introduction? Because as far as new companion appearances, other than the fact that he looks weird, I don't know if he is all that impactful. I mean, I'm going to be honest with you. I'd have much rather had Urag continue on with them. At least he seemed to have a personality.
Yeah, Karras is pretty bland here. If they hadn't gone through the trouble of really, really pointing out how different looking he is, then he could just very well have been another human companion at this point anyway.
Well, I mean, I don't necessarily think that you have to have him like acting like completely weird. But I feel like we should get something more than just a crazy description of how he looks in order to, mm-hmm. to make him an alien. I don't know. It just seems like we really didn't get to know him all that much, and maybe that was purposeful for the ideas that they want to go with him, but it's just not, I don't think it's a good first impression to make.
Big Finish may not have solidified what they wanted from the character at this point.
I think they do, because they certainly drop the hints at the end of the story to try to make you interested in him. And so I think they have a plan that they're going to go with, and we'll mm-hmm. get through that in the upcoming stories. But I just don't know if we should have had more from Karras himself rather than having to be told by this omniscient narrator, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what do you make of Karras, Rachel?
I mean, like, when we first see him, he's, like, having this terrible trauma, and then towards the end he has to kill his wife, and you're just like, this is, like, I just feel for the guy. Like, I'm like, you're having a really bad day, man.
It was a terrible day.
And I think I get to where they were going to go. He gets so focused on death. Like, he spends two episodes saying nothing but, we've got to kill Charlie. We've got to kill Charlie. We've got to kill Charlie. We're like, whoa, settle down there, Haas. Or I know you had to do it to your own wife. And obviously the idea is he's so disturbed by what he had to do to his wife that in order for him to be able to accept what he did, he's got to do it to Charlie too, because if they can bring Charlie back, then he has to face the realization that maybe he didn't make the right choice.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is an interesting dynamic. I just don't think they played that up enough during the course of the story. It's just almost too subtle in order for it to be an interesting aspect of his character.
Yeah, it's just... And I feel like, having been through the whole Divergent universe, like, I feel like his character gets better as it goes on. But
certainly,
as far as an introduction, yeah, it's a bit messy and confusing. But you know, the Divergent universe loves being confusing anyway. So
he is just he's got personality traits of, oh, he's angry. And he doesn't like being told what to do. And so, okay, sure, that's like whatever, but we don't really get much more than that. And I think they wanted to. It's just maybe they could have had somebody with a defter hand in characterization write his first story. And once again, we're back to Philip Martin failing utterly again. I don't know. I mean, I'm a big fan of Turlough, so I don't think that your companions need necessarily be likable upon first appearance, but you've got to have something about them that makes them stand out and makes you interested in following, even if you don't like the character. Kara's just doesn't have anything of that here in this first story.
Yeah, there's nothing in this story that really makes me look forward to the future stories that he'll be in.
Yeah, and it's like they think, well, if we tell you something mysterious about him at the end of the story, you'll be interested in him. Like, and that's just not enough. it seems like a gormless way to try to make you interested in this new guy. So I guess that's it with Kara's. I want to play one other clip here, and let's just play that, and we'll be right back.
All right.
There you are. Late. We should be served first. Didn't anyone tell you that?
No, sir.
High Directorate, then Genetics. I had your predecessor composted for delivering cold food.
Sorry, sir.
This is your last and only warning. Why does it take two of you to deliver the food? This is serious overstaffing.
I just happen to be in the same elevator. Are you Genetics?
Assistant to the controller.
I want to register a complaint.
Okay, so, I'm sorry. Was that a Croman or was that Syl? Because it really felt like it was Syl saying it, but yet it's this big bug-headed monster instead. So yeah, the Croman are nothing but cheap knockoffs, and we kind of have talked about this ending to death, but again, like I said, I think this was a story that probably he wanted to have Sylve in it, and it probably was written with the idea that Sylve was going to be in it and then couldn't, so it had to be changed at the last minute, but it is totally a mentor story.
Oh, and I certainly, I heard not just Syl in that, but being a Star Trek fan, I heard the Ferengi
sure.
in that. And I in my reading, I found out, I guess this is something of one of Philip Barton's pet things that he likes to put in stories is this anti-capitalism, anti-fascism element. And, kind of hitting you over the head with a mallet here to drive the point home.
And, I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, at least it's got, like, some sort of context to what he's trying to say. So I'll give him, like, some credit for that. But again, why rehash it in this whole divergent universe, and why not come up with something new or a new spin on it rather than just put a different name to the same characterization?
Well, because it's been, what, at the point this came out, it's been about 20 years since Vengeance of Eros. A lot of people probably hadn't seen Vengeance of Eros when this came out. You know, now the DVDs and home video are a lot easier to get hold of than they were even 10 years ago. So
I guess I can concede point.
It was a way he was able to cheat a little better, shall we say, that, here we are in 2014 looking at it, and it's oh so obvious because, especially the three of us are so well informed on WHO history. A lot of people who are listening to this may not have known about Vengeance of Eros and Syl, and so would not have made these connections that we're making so easily.
I mean, and yes, I guess from a point of view, you are absolutely correct. They may not have, though. I would say that anybody that's actually buying Big Finish is certainly has seen some Veros, at least at this point in time.
And I'm not saying it makes it right. I'm just saying that may be the thinking that went into it.
Sure. I don't know. He just. Philip Martin, he is just a product of his age, and I don't know if he really knows how to write for audio, because boy, this story has some of the clunkiest audio description and dialogue that Big Finish has had since the very beginning. It's like, oh, we're right back in 1999 again, and people are just trying to figure out how to write for audio. Big Finish had this figured out by now, and there's no way they should have let some of this clunky dialogue through a sort of editorial process.
Now, I haven't listened to his other Big Finish story, which is Sixth Doctor Flip, Antidote to Oblivion, which actually does have Syl.
Yes.
Is it better?
Yes, but I think by that... See, at this point in time in Big Finish's history, I think it's... I think Gary Russell will be the first one to admit it to you that Gary Russell is completely burned out with running this company.
Okay.
We're going to see over the next year or two the wheels just seem to have come off Big Finish. It won't be until Nick Briggs comes in and takes over for Gary Russell with kind of a fresh sensibility that the ship starts to get righted again. I mean, there's going to be like a handful of gems and stuff like that, but I just think behind the scenes, things are so kind of chaotic, and the people in charge are just exhausted from this incessant pace that they've given themselves.
Okay.
And there's just only a couple of people running it at this point in time that they just don't have the sense of control that they probably should. And so by the time we get to Philip Martin writing that story with the Sixth Doctor and Flip, Big Finish has a much better behind the scenes process going on that they can kind of help usher the script through a better editorial process.
All right.
Of course, that's just me talking out my butt. I don't know if that's exactly what's happened, but that's just the impression that I get. So anyway, yeah, this one, I don't know. What are we missing here? Oh, I guess we should talk about the Kroka, because he's going to be somebody that we're going to be revisiting over and over again in these stories.
That's the name I kept forgetting.
Yeah, I guess as far as villains go, I much prefer him to the Kroman. At least he's got some personality to him for the couple of scenes that we get with him.
Yeah, kind of a White Guardian, Black Guardian vibe to him. You know, this possibly omniscient creature,
sure,
behind the scenes manipulating events. So I am interested to see where that goes in the coming stories.
Yeah, he can definitely be somebody that I can see being interesting to pop up again and again, and just to at least spar verbally with the Doctor.
Yeah, at this point, I'm more interested in the Kroka than I am in Kariz.
Oh, yeah. That's for certain. He's got his powers, and he seems to be working for somebody, running experiments. So we'll see how that turns out. I don't know, guys. I don't know. This is kind of a short one here, but... anybody have anything else they want to talk about Kroman? Again, I don't know if I have much more to say about it other than I don't know if I really liked it. I guess we could talk about the performances. I just, again, after the stellar performances that we got from McGann and Fisher in the last story, it just feels like they're kind of running through the motions here. But I don't know if that's necessarily their fault. It's just the characterization that they're being given.
Yeah. This is the second one in a row where Paul McGann and India Fisher do the best they can with what they're given. I just don't necessarily like what they were given to do that much.
See, well, I mean, of course, I disagree with you. I think Scherzo gave them the best material they've had pretty much the entirety of a Big Finish as far as putting on their actor hat and emoting. Here, it's just basic, oh, run through corridors and let's happily throw mud balls. Haha, so fun.
Yeah, this was a definitely a letdown for me after the last one, because I feel like their performances were just incredible, and then to sort of throw them into this even stranger universe where even more terrible things are happening, but with sort of the episodic plot elements of a typical episode, it just felt very, it felt very jarring, and maybe it's because the emotions are so heightened, but I don't know, it felt very it felt very weird. Like when I listened to this whole arc, I was like, what's happening? So.
Yeah. Well, I guess then let's go ahead and wrap this up and rate it. So, Jeff, you are our guest, so we'll let you start.
All right. Well, I'm also going to give this 1 of 3, which I hate to do to an Eighth Doctor story, especially an Eighth Doctor and Charlie story, but I did it last week. I'm going to do it again this week. It's good. I did like it, but it's far from great. When I go to listen to an Eighth Doctor and Charlie story, this isn't one I'm going to be putting on my iPhone again anytime soon.
All right. Well, Rachel, why don't you go ahead and give us your thoughts?
I'm going to give it like a 3, just because.
Wow, you guys are being way generous.
Or maybe a 2.5, just because the plot and just the things that happen to Charlie are really disturbing. And it's really hard to listen to. I mean, the performances are what you would expect from McGann and Fisher, but the material was really disturbing to me. So I'll give it a 2.5.
Yeah, this gets a 1 for me. I have not disliked the story this much since The Land of the Dead. And honestly, I think I have to apologize to Stephen Cole for berating that one so much, because this is worse. I am sorry. I don't really find anything redeeming about the story whatsoever. It's got horrible rape overtones to it. It's a retread of everything Philip Martin has already done and just feels out of place in 2000 and three or four, whatever heck we're in at this point in time. And
January 2004.
Yeah, there we go. January. See, look, I'm right there in between. So 2004. So yeah, it's just, and it's such a retread and such a poor follow-up and a letdown on the innovative situation that the Doctor and Charlie should have found themselves in after the end of Zagreus. And now we're right back to just a random alien planet with random aliens doing bad things, and the Doctor and Charlie are going to joyfully go in and muck it all up. I just think it was a colossal mistake to have this story written. I don't know what they were thinking to place this story here. It just feels like, I don't want to like besmirch Philip Martin or anything, but it's not like he's like this big name in Doctor Who. He wrote 2 stories in the era of Doctor Who that is generally regarded as being, you know, not great, and mm-hmm. almost got the show canceled. So to then bring him in to have him essentially tell the same story as 2 of those not great stories, it seems so misguided to me. I honestly can't even begin to think what they were thinking about doing that, because obviously this is what they expected they were going to get, a 1980s type of story telling the same exact thing that he's already written twice before. They could not have been surprised. So I don't know why they felt like this was the best way to follow up and set the tone for the rest of the Divergent universe. I don't know if the Divergent universe stories are necessarily bad from this point on, but my memory tells me that they are, and it pretty much all boils down from the tone that Creed of the Crowman and sets up. Now, obviously, next week or next month, we're going to be talking about Natural History of Fear, which is one of the all-time greats of Big Finish, but that's, you know, the exception, not the rule for the Divergent universe. So, mm-hmm. I don't know. It just does not work for me. So, yeah, it's getting a 1. And I hate doing it, but I just, there's nothing here that I really like. So, I feel much better. That's very cathartic to get that out. So, all right. Well, that does it for another episode. We'll be back in a week's time where we will be talking about First Frontier by David McKinty, featuring the return of the Master to the new adventures. Oh, so be sure to join us for that. In the meantime, if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can always reach us by email at theoncomingstormpodcast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Facebook by searching for The Oncoming Storm. You can like our Facebook page and join in the conversation there. You can find me and Ashley on Twitter. I am at The Oncoming Josh, and Ashley is at Islair. And of course, our new episodes are posted at our website and on iTunes, and if you would be so kind, you can give us a review on iTunes, which I actually, you know, I noticed we actually got a review on iTunes by a kind listener a couple of months back, and I forgot to mention it, so thank you ever so much. I really should have been prepared and could give you your due, but maybe we'll do that again in the future, but you know who you are. Thank you, and we do appreciate that. But other than that, Rachel, how can people find you online if they're so inclined to do so?
They can find me at All Back to Front on Facebook.
And Jeff, I know we're still kind of working behind the scenes on that podcast. Anything else you want to plug or give us any information how people can find you if they want to?
Well, it's still October. This is coming out, so I'll plug the Facebook page of my family's Halloween haunt home display, which is the Polier Graveyard. That's Polier spelled P as in Portland, O-L-I-E-R. And you search for Polier Graveyard on Facebook, and you can see all the home custom-made tombstones that we've made and put on display and do every year.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me, Jeff, and kind of filling in to last minute. I do appreciate that, especially after everything that you've been through over the last couple of weeks.
And, oh, yeah. I loved it.
That really means a lot to me. So thank you so much. And, of course, thank you, Rachel, for being the only one here on the show that I actually like for showing up.
Oh, thanks, Josh.
As for the other two clowns, we'll forget them. All right. Well, we'll see everybody in a week. Until then, take care, and we'll see you soon.
Bye, everyone. Thanks for listening.
Bye.
You have been listening to The Oncoming Storm, a Doctor Who spin-off media podcast. All thoughts and opinions are solely those of the host and do not represent those of Mad Norwegian Press, the Timegate Convention, or any other organizations they manage to worm their way into. Contact us at theoncomingstormpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook. Be sure to like our page on Facebook to get all of the latest information on the show. Get new episodes through iTunes or at our website, www.theoncomingstorm.libsyn.com.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at esonetwork.com.